Meeting of the Joint Special Committee on Land Use Fairness for Thursday, February 22, 2007. Let me describe what our work program is for this evening. The notice for this meeting states that it is an informational meeting with a continuation of invited testimony by ballot measure 37 stakeholder groups. We have been holding public hearings on Senate Bill 505 for the last several meetings. The public testimony on Senate Bill 505 concluded on Tuesday of this week, and as we announced at that meeting, that was the end of the public testimony for the time being on Senate Bill 505. And
excuse me, sir, that's not what was said. I can't sit
here
and be quiet.
Well, I'm
said to come back and that we were signed up and we were ready to go, but you can't do it tonight. We ran out of time.
Let me describe to you what happened. We had last several meetings, we had rollover testimony. That is, people were invited to come back to the next meeting if we didn't get to them. And that was true for the people who had signed up last Thursday evening, and the notice for Tuesday, 2 days ago, said that only those people who were returning from the preceding Thursday would be heard on Tuesday, and all of those people.
We had a list.
We had a list of the people who had signed up, and those were the people who were called, and we stayed overtime in order to hear from those people. And the notice for this evening, and I remember specifically a week ago this evening, my urging people to make sure before they made a trip to the Capitol to check online to see what the notice of the meeting said, to see whether we would be taking further public testimony from new signups. And the notice of this meeting says an informational meeting with invited stakeholder testimony only. So that's the work plan for this evening. And I'm sorry if people didn't get that word or somebody else mischaracterized what was going to happen, somebody from outside of the Capitol. But that is the way the meeting notice of the meeting was given.
Mr. Chair, the other thing for individuals who do want to give testimony at this point, since we do not have any other public testimony scheduled for Senate Bill 505 that's going to be heard here at the dais, you have the right to send stuff to us written. It can be in electronic form. It can be handwritten, typed, however you might want to get it, and get it to our administrator, and it will be part of the record. The other thing I do need to let the House members know that I had two senators that had other obligations tonight, and for the record, they are excused. Senator Schrader and Senator Johnson should be marked as excused from being in attendance tonight.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Senator George.
Is it possible for them, if they have written testimony, to just turn it to our administrator?
Oh, sure. Sure. Hand it in at the committee staff. And
I don't think it's fair to come down here and waste our time.
Well, the problem here is that we have no public notice for public testimony. We would be in violation to allow anyone to testify when it has not been noticed because of how the rules are set up for the legislature to operate. Sorry for the inconvenience as well as the misunderstandings, but the record, I think, if you look at it and the statements that Co-Chair McPherson made last Thursday, as well as the notices that have come since then, last Friday, as well as what the revisions that were done after that time, we had another one that was posted on Wednesday to take care of the changing of what was going to be done tonight, makes it clearer. I understand that some individuals may have been called or told that they should come in. I don't know what group told you to do that, but clearly they are not right, and I'm sorry that they gave you misinformation. We have to stay within the rules that we have to run hearings, and if we go outside of those to accommodate people that are here tonight, we'd be in violation for those who may have wanted to be here but stayed away because they were informed or they knew that they weren't supposed to be here. If we have additional testimony in the future, it will be noticed. And then anyone who wants to give public testimony orally will be able to do that at that time. But at this point, the oral record is closed, and what you will have to do is rely on submitting whatever written testimony that you want.
Okay. With that, I'll open an informational meeting on ballot measure 37 with invited testimony from the stakeholder group, and I want to invite forward Marvin Brown, Ted Lawrenson, and Hal Sawasser.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, Chair Posansky, members of the committee. I'm Marvin Brown. I'm the director of the Department of Forestry. It's a pleasure to be here this evening and talk to you about forestry as it relates to ballot measure 37. And I assume that's the the information that you wanted to talk about tonight.
Yes.
I'm going to just provide a little bit of national perspective on the issue of working forest lands and how that relates to Oregon. Dean Salwasser's got some excellent information about the values of the forest, and Ted Lawrence, an assistant state forester with the Department of Forestry, is going to finish up with some specific discussion about impacts here in Oregon, and we'll try to wrap that up then with a little more discussion. The things that I wanted to say about this topic is, first of all, the loss, this issue of losing working forests is a national phenomenon. You can go anywhere you want to, from southeast United States to coastal Carolinas, New England, Lake States. They're all dealing with a concern about losing working forests in the landscapes. And it's happening for a lot of different reasons. In Oregon, that phenomenon has been prolonged because of the land use laws. They have been effective at slowing that national trend down. They haven't stopped it, and it's probably at a point where the pressures are going to be felt even more in the future, regardless of any ballot measure 37 issues, I think. And I'll talk about a little bit why those pressures are coming to bear. Some examples. The state of Maine has bought and sold a third of the entire state in the last 7 years. Due to some of these trends that are converging when it comes to working forest lands. State of Georgia, their legislature recently commissioned a study to look at the future of the forest industry in the state of Georgia based on the fact that since 2001, that industry in Georgia, which is traditionally a real powerhouse forestry state, has lost $10 billion in value. So it's not a unique phenomenon to feel the pressures for these lands to be lost. The reasons, and I'll just go real quickly into a couple of things here. Obviously, population is part of it, and I'm sure you all have heard that in some of your other discussions, but there's more people retiring and moving to places that were traditionally working forests, like the coast of Carolina, like Oregon. And there's more people who have the disposable income to buy that land and not really expect a return from it. That's just the nature of the population that we're dealing with, and I don't know that we're going to change that. The other piece, though, is why are in all of these places the forest-based economies contracting? And these wouldn't stand Dean Salwasser's rigors of scientific investigation, but just from my own observation, it has to do with the global competitiveness, for one. The United States has the highest environmental and social standards in the world when it comes to the practice of forestry and the production of forest products. We have inherently a pretty high tax burden on privately owned stumpage in the United States. That means, in general, we have a higher fiber cost than a lot of places in the world. At the same time, there's been a lot of policy decisions in the United States that have contracted the supply of timber, both on public lands and on private land. When the supply contracts, then costs go up even further. As all those costs go up and industries decide to move elsewhere to be more competitive, then private landowners have less market opportunity and have less incentive to actually invest in managing and owning timberland. And so it becomes kind of a vicious spiral where the two pieces of the puzzle feed on themselves. There's fewer industries there to buy wood fiber and provide a market incentive to own it. As that happens, there's fewer landowners delivering it, and the supply gets tighter and the costs get higher, and it becomes more difficult to operate. And that's a phenomenon that's happening everywhere in the country. A lot of the core things that have to happen can't happen here just in Oregon. They're going to have to be at a national level. We're going to have to deal with foreign policy. We're going to have to deal with timber tax policy in the United States, public land management policy, environmental regulation, the government's role in delivering some other kinds of revenue opportunities, such as environmental values on lands. Those are things that really need to happen at the national level. But they do, I think, relate back to a lot of the issues that you're discussing here with ballot measure 37, because in the end, for a forest resource to be sustainable, it has to have the revenue opportunities that make it competitive with just simply being a piece of real estate. And I'll just leave you with one example on that particular issue and then turn it over to Dean Salwasser. When I worked in industry some years ago and was asked to look at one of the regions that the company had, one of the timberland regions, I did some business analysis and compared what the present net value of those acres were if we were to just manage it sustainably as a normal forest and, you know, receive the products off of that land for, you know, the foreseeable future. And how did that present net value relate to what I knew we could get if we just put the whole property up for sale on the open market, all 175,000 acres? And the difference between the present net value of managing that land for timber and just simply putting it on the market, we could have earned nearly six times as much money just simply putting the land out for sale as holding it and managing it for timber. And that's not an untypical ratio. And I think Ted's got a slide that he's going to show you here that compares several states. But that's the kind of disparity that we're dealing with when we talk about trying to maintain working forests on the landscape. So I'm going to quit there, and I'm going to turn it over to my colleagues.
Thank you. Chair Pruszynski, Chair McPherson, committee members, I'm Hal Salwasser. I'm the Dean of the College of Forestry and the Director of the Oregon Forest Research Laboratory at Oregon State University. And I'm pleased to have an opportunity to describe to you tonight some of the many benefits that forests bring to our quality of life in Oregon and some of the impacts of land use change on those benefits. Forests cover 28 million acres of our state, about 45% of the land area. They define much of the identity of Oregonians. Forests cover the headwater basins of every major river system in this state, and most of the precipitation that falls in Oregon falls on a forest. Some of the water percolates into the soil, some flows to the streams, some enters water tables deep beneath the soil surface. All of it is the highest quality water that flows from any land use in the state. All of it is vital to virtually every facet of our economy and community life. When forests are converted to other land uses, such as agricultural, industrial, or residential, water quality and the timing of flows from those converted lands is impacted, often negatively. Salmon also define much of the identity of Oregon. They and many other native fish species spawn and live parts or all of their lives in forested streams, rivers, and lakes. Forested landscapes, whether managed or unmanaged, are vital to the well-being of fish, and it goes beyond the roles they play in the water system. The forests grow the organic matter that enters the food chain for many fish species. Healthy riparian areas cool the streams and rivers, keeping water temperatures cool and allowing insects and leaves to fall into the water, important sources of nutrients for fish. When forests are converted to non-forest land uses, native fish rarely come out better than when they had a forest for a home. I'm a wildlife ecologist by education. I became a forester because the critters I loved and studied lived in the woods. Many of our native amphibians, reptiles, birds, and mammals must have forests for their habitat. Some of them require old, unmanaged forests, and others require young forests that follow a disturbance such as a storm, a fire, or a flood, or timber harvest. Many must have forests, woodlands, or agricultural lands at lower elevations for their winter habitats, just the kind of land most vulnerable to land use conversion. Sustaining the rich diversity of native wildlife in Oregon depends on a well-connected and abundant habitats that include low-elevation forests. Land use conversion usually fragments and reduces forest habitats to the detriment of native wildlife. Fire is a natural part of forests in our state. Fires burn with varying intensity depending on the kind of forest, its disturbance history, and daily weather. Wetter old forests tend to burn at high intensity but not very frequently. 200 to 400 years is common. Drier open forests burn more frequently, but not as intensely, some as frequent as every 3 to 7 years, when nature and first Americans were in charge. Now the drier forests are not so open due to a history of fire suppression and lack of management. They have excessive amounts of biomass, and they burn in bigger, more intense fires than may have ever burned. When this happens in a landscape that lacks buildings, forest managers can either allow the fire to treat the forest to its natural death and rebirth process, or they can try to suppress the fire. In remote, unroaded wilderness areas, letting the fires burn may eventually be the preferred approach. But on private lands and roaded forest lands, putting the fires out is nearly always the preferred option. If there are no buildings on the landscape, suppressing the fires is less dangerous and less costly. But if the landscape includes even a few places that have been converted to residential uses, fighting the fires is usually much more dangerous and far more costly, oftentimes as much as 5 times more costly. Lives are lost, property is damaged, federal, state, and local treasuries pick up the tab, a tab that has exceeded $100 million on fires in Oregon in many years of this century. Forest conversion to residential uses, even at low densities of homes, passes higher fire management costs and higher safety hazards to every level of government. Wood is another of Oregon's rich forest benefits. The tremendous ability to grow trees in Oregon and make wood products used in everyone's daily life is a major reason that many landowners keep their land in forests instead of some other kind of land use. The forest cluster, all the entities that are engaged in managing and forests and educating people in turning the wood into wood products, the forest cluster contributes about $13 billion to Oregon's economy every year and directly employs over 85,000 people at family wage jobs, often in rural communities that have limited employment opportunities. They're the mainstay of many rural communities. Oregon is the largest state producer of construction lumber in the nation. We're a net exporter of softwood products, and their sales drive a large part of Oregon's traded sector economy. What that means is that other people's dollars flow into the state to support Oregon jobs, our tax base, and public services. Wood products also benefit Oregon's environment as well as its economy. Homes built with wood, as much wood as possible, are far more energy friendly than homes built with steel or concrete substituted for wood. The wood house from the forest to the house itself uses less water, creates less pollution than the steel frame or concrete wall home. Oregon's forests also sequester and store vast amounts of carbon. Globally, deforestation has historically released 27% as much greenhouse gas to the atmosphere as all fossil fuel emissions. Keeping forest lands and forest uses and increasing the durability of wood products are positive factors in keeping our global climate livable. Oregon hasn't been as deforested as other places due to its land use system and economic incentives to keep forest land and forest uses, but it was on that path prior to the early 1980s. Keeping Oregon's land and forest requires that the private forest land and forest products businesses be competitive in an aggressive global marketplace, as State Forester Brown has just said. That in turn requires predictable and abundant supplies of raw materials, wood, a rational and science-informed regulatory environment, and constant innovation and investment in forest management practices, product manufacturing, and business systems. Forest conversion reduces the wood supply, which reduces the incentive to invest in wood products manufacturing capacity, which reduces competitiveness and markets, which reduces the need to keep forest land and forest uses in the first place. It's a feedback loop that is leading to rampant forest conversion in other parts of the nation. It need not happen in Oregon. Let me conclude. Forest products, Oregon's forest and forest products infrastructure are vital to sustaining quality of life in Oregon, and they are a key competitive advantage for the future of the state in turbulent economic times and increasing globalization. Whether the focus is on the many environmental and social benefits our rich forests deliver or the significant roles they play in our economy and quality of life, when the forest is no longer a forest, all those benefits are foregone. This is why the first principle of forestry is keep forest lands and forest uses for forest values. Thank you for asking me to come.
Thank you, Dean Sowasser.
Chair Pazansky and Chair McPherson, I'm Ted Morrison, Assistant State Forester with the Oregon Department of Forestry.
I'm going to add some details to a lot of the information that was already presented. I've asked State Forester Brown and Dean Salwasser to jump in, especially if I need to get my foot pulled out of my mouth. But do want to add some additional context. Again, between 1982 and 1997, on a national scale, the amount of land that was deforested equal in size to the state of Washington. We expect that about 50 million acres over 50 years, 1 million acres per year will be converted over the next 50 years. And in that context, our population expected to grow quite a bit faster than the national average. Here's a map showing the conversion between those years. As you'll note, the state of Washington has a much more area marked in red. They've seen quite a level of conversion and loss of forest land to forest uses as compared to Oregon. One of the things we've seen as forestry and forest management has evolved, there's been a number of primary challenges. Initially, in the early 1900s, wildfire was the big issue. By the mid-1900s, deforestation was the big issue. And by the late 1900s, environmental awareness was the big issue. Now, as we've said, fragmentation development of forest land appears to be the big issue. But that's combined with other issues. They continue to provide a necessary set of challenges to address, but the fragmentation and development issue makes it more challenging. As this shift has occurred, there's also a number of new players in the arena that we've got to think about. And again, not to point any fingers at perspectives on how people might view the world, but we have a number of new players in terms of the landowner groups that are called REITs and TIMOs that have a different perspective and oftentimes view conversion of forest land to higher and better uses as an important part of their portfolio. Similarly, the environmental and conservation groups that are the trust-type groups like the Nature Conservancies are playing a bigger role nationally in addressing a lot of this issue. In terms of why is this important, well, at least in terms of the working forest that Marvin described, the forest industry now contributes over 70% of Oregon's timber harvest, with the non-adjusted private forest lands contributing a large share, as well as the state lands, and the federal lands are contributing a smaller sector over time. Forest revenue is an important part of county's revenue. I know a number of you have heard the discussions in the Rural Schools Act. This is an example for Douglas County. The bottom line message is look at Douglas County's total county revenue, 34% is provided by timber revenues. Marvin talked about the non-forest profitability issue, and this is information that's provided to us by Forest Capital LLC, the new ownership partners in terms of Boise Cascade lands. They've gone through and done an analysis of how their lands that they purchased in a large scale over the last several years would mark out in terms of selling them in terms of real estate values. As you can see, it varies around the country, with Idaho, interesting enough, being 6.5 times the value for real estate purposes as timber values. And certainly we see the behaviors of landowners in that state reflecting that big difference. But in Oregon as well, there's a very large gap between real estate values and timber values, and that's certainly putting a lot of pressure on people's choices. The Forestry Program for Oregon, which is the Board of Forestry's policy, basically addresses what Dean Salwasser said is the bottom line choice in terms of how you maintain your forest, that you've got to maintain the basic productive capacity, the land base, to ensure that it'll contribute to Oregon's economic well-being. In that sense, they have a specific action in terms of promoting the retention and improvements of the forest land base and long-term investments by landowners. The board also recognizes there's different owners that have different objectives, and we need to think about those different roles as we talk about land use and ballot measure 37. This is a schematic that represents the different emphases that the Board of Forestry recognizes on the forest landscape. Wood production emphasis forest, mainly the industrial lands, is where the timber production comes from. Nature emphasis forest is dominantly the federal lands. Multi-use forests are most consistently like state or tribal-owned lands, some family-owned lands. And then finally, we have the residential value emphasis forest. All four of these categories of forests have to contribute to sustainability of our forest lands and the contributions they provide. The residential value forest is where we're seeing the big pressure for increased development and the impacts that we're concerned about. generally what we've seen in terms of the behavior on forest lands around the nation is the wood production forests tend to get bifurcated as they're sold the highest and best use. Some of them go to residential value forests, and some of them go to the nature emphasis or multi-use emphasis forest. In either case, it results in less timber production, and it reinforces that downward spiral that we're seeing across the country and to some degree in Oregon. The Department of Forestry has a land use planning program. It has a number of objectives. The first is to maintain the forest land base. The second is to maintain the productivity of that land base, and we'll get some specifics on that later. The third is to promote active management of Oregon's forest lands by limiting conflict to commercial management of forest land, related to site and dwellings or other improvements or non-forest uses. The fourth is to reduce costs and conflict related to fire prevention and suppression. And the final objective is to encourage thoughtful planning and oversight of development activities that convert forest lands to non-forest uses. In many cases, that's designed to help provide for green infrastructure as development does occur. Dean Salas mentioned the land use program has been very effective in Oregon, and here's an example of that. Again, before the planning laws were passed, the rate of conversion was moderate. As the land use plans were implemented, the rate of conversion declined. In 1994, with the passage of House Bill 3661, we saw a very stabilizing effect of the land use program. That's continued through this time. This really kind of gets to the bottom line message. If you look at the different categories of ownership, we have a tremendous opportunity here in terms of our choices. As the forest land base is maintained or increased or decreased, it'll result in whether the forest lands will provide their potential or actual planned harvest or something much less than that. As I described, the industrial lands now contribute nearly 3 billion board feet, and as they make choices about where those lands are going to go in terms of highest or best use or other non-wood production interests, their production may well decline substantially. They drive the system. The family forest lands have a tremendous amount of potential to increase their timber production, and we have the choice through our land use program to sustain that land base and indeed increase the production off of it. The OFRI study looking at the forest sector concluded that it would be fairly easy to increase the timber production by as much as 1 billion board feet without necessarily changing harvest on federal forest lands, which would result in as many as 17,000 direct jobs, would allow the forest cluster to further develop, and would address a number of the market and infrastructure problems we're seeing in eastern Oregon and other places around the Northwest. Other choices can clearly reduce that production and continue to reduce the market and infrastructure. And we certainly have seen many places in eastern Oregon where the choice that landowners have with regard to markets has declined dramatically, and their ability to make a living off their forest lands has declined. The family forest landers play a really important part in all this scheme. And again, they're not necessarily residential forests, but they behave in ways that oftentimes have residential values as a big part of their interest. They do have a large potential to increase their contributions, and they are essential to maintain the infrastructure. Particularly in some counties in eastern Oregon, family forest landowners are actually now the biggest contributor to the timber harvest base. That's something to think about. They certainly add to the quality of life. They have a broad range of interests and values, but, and this is where ballot measure 37 is a big but, as the number of residents that come from out of state or have not connection to forest lands move into the state, they're not well connected to the environment, and they oftentimes have different expectations and values around forestry that create conflicts and other problems. We do know as building density increases on forest lands that it does result in some consequences to investments in private forest management. This is an example of pre-commercial thinning. These are Oregon data. But as the number of dwellings go up per square mile, the adjacent lands, both family forest lands in the blue and the pink, forest industry lands, see a decline in investment in pre-commercial thinning to about 42 dwellings per square mile. You see a very large disinvestment in those type of investment activities. Some of that results from a number of factors, but this is an example of a recent set of folks that are very concerned about forest management. They don't like herbicide use. They result in a number of costs in terms of the landowner's interest, and certainly they result in the state being a role of having to manage those conflicts in a way that is sensitive to the range of interest, but does reflect our forest laws at this point in time. Dean Sowasser mentioned the fire issue. These are Oregon data for Oregon protected lands. I'd say that probably the costs that are represented here and the risks are represented here would be somewhat different if you looked at federal lands, particularly the cost side. But we looked at the Sisters area, and as you look at the number of dwellings per square mile, they increase, the probability of a fire start goes up dramatically. Very clearly, large fires that threaten dwellings, at least on state-protected land, are about 50% more expensive to fight. And again, if you start throwing in the federal numbers, it would probably be substantially greater than that. Many parts of Oregon are in a fire regime condition class that reflects a highly altered or significantly altered environment. And again, by putting dwellings out in these areas, it affects how you can manage those fuels and your choices around fire suppression and protection. Another issue that's often not thought about, but it's something that's very emotional to us, is the landslide issue. And this is a fascinating example, and this is not an isolated example. Basically, a year ago on New Year's Day, there was a heavy rainfall event. A landslide came out of a BLM unit, unharvested, and it went across the road and deposited in the yards of the residents pictured in the picture. The building permit below the topographic map is for the new home that's now being built on the deposited debris flow material. And we see that repeated all over Oregon, and it's starting to become an increased phenomenon. What that does, it puts people at risk, but it also constrains how those lands can be managed in ways that are pretty substantial. As again, you can see the watershed area where BLM will probably now be very reluctant to do any forest management. As Dean Sowasser mentioned, forest lands provide a range of good and value, goods and values, but in terms of numbers, approximately 50% of Oregonians get their drinking water partially or totally from surface water, most of which is forest lands. Number of fish and wildlife impacts, and Dean Sowasser mentioned those, but one that's not talked about and thought about are infrastructure conflicts. And the picture of the large woody debris, a function which is essential to fish habitat, becomes a conflict as people put in bridges and culverts and other types of infrastructure, or even homes within the floodplain. And indeed, after the floods this winter, we had an interesting conflict along the Sandy River where there was helicopter removal of some wonderful log jams that had been created to protect homes. Forest lands also provide future opportunity. Dean Sowasser mentioned the opportunity for carbon sequestration, but we're also sitting on a potential gold mine in terms of renewable energy. In the short term, it's probably electrical generation, but in the longer term, biofuels are a huge potential that will give Oregon both an opportunity to generate new income as well as provide for fuel self-sufficiency. From a policy standpoint, there's kind of four broad strategies that we can look at that have been used to promote private forests. And I'll jump to the fourth one because that's the one that's been used in Oregon the most, which is fundamentally our land use program, which does decrease non-forest values while not compensating landowners, which really is the thrust of ballot measure 37. Because we've had the land use program in place, we've really not developed these other strategies very well. But in terms of the first approach is to increase traditional forest profitability. And again, Canada has taken some very strong steps to boost the profitability of their forest industry. One of the issues that Congress will be dealing with this year is the Farm Bill. We need to think about how we might use that as a tool. Another strategy is to increase non-traditional forestry profitability. And again, that's looking at providing ways for landowners to capture value out of other assets, such as wildlife, ecosystem services, or to capture value in terms of their development opportunities through a conservation easement or development right purchase. There's, again, decreasing non-forest values, which is more traditionally the conservation easement or development right purchase approach. Kind of the final observations, basically all states are confronting this issue as globalization and rising costs erode forest profitability, and while alternative values escalate, does result in a number of risks to Oregon, and certainly it also impacts the green infrastructure needed to attract other new industries. But compared to other states, Oregon's certainly well positioned to protect its private forest. We certainly have the land use laws. Again, they've had some consequences, maybe unintended, that we need to address. We certainly have science-based forest practice rules. I would make the point that one of the things we do consider as we adopt rules is to make them economically efficient so people will not be compelled to convert their forest lands. Where we're known for our forest growth and wood quality, we do have a great forest cluster, which does include OSU College of Forestry, even though my school is not that one. And we have a great connection between forest, green space, and our sense of identity. But action's needed. We have a proposal that we call our Community Forestry Initiative, which State Forest will talk about a little bit here. The legislature adopted the new concept of community forestry authorities last session. We think that's an important new tool. It's likely the Forest Legacy Program will be expanded, where we could, again, use it to help landowners retain their forest land and forest uses by acquiring development rights or conservation easements. And Senate Bill 98, a new bill, is a bill that would protect working forests and use revenue from those forests for higher education. So it is very clear that additional tools and incentives are needed. The Board of Forestry has adopted an indicator to measure the protection of land base. It's also a progress board benchmark. We do have monitoring in place to track this and had had monitoring in place for a number of years. On about a five-year cycle, we look at the rate of forest land conversion and the development of dwellings and their density across the landscape and the impacts on forest management that's created. So with that, be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Lorenzen. Are there questions from the committee to any of the members of the panel? Representative Clem.
I have one. I don't know if it's rhetorical or not. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, the first part of the presentation, and I appreciate at the end making clear that for a while we've been bearing, you know, some private landowners are bearing the cost of this. But I guess it's maybe rhetorical. Forestry and farms, if all of these, essentially I heard you say, you know, not you, but rich Californians move up here and want to buy this land and sit on it and enjoy the view, where's the wood for the house and what food are they going to eat?
The wood for the house is coming from Canada. The food's coming from South America.
Not for that.
And I guess from the standpoint of the choices we have to make, I mean, very clearly people would argue we're exporting some environmental costs in doing that. But I think it goes well beyond that in the sense of the opportunity costs that the state's losing are huge. But ultimately, it boils down to our quality of life and our character of life. And we're losing that if we don't think about this as well.
Senator Byer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ted, your one graph on building density and pre-commercial thinning by private forest owners, to me, the thing that's missing off of that graph, it looks very stark, but there's a couple of things missing off of it. First is, I guess, time, and second is forest practices and how they've changed over time. Because 20 years ago, pre-commercial thinning was quite extensive on industry and non-industrial land alike. Today, it is almost non-existent on either. And it's not because of home density, it's because of market change and forest practice change.
Chair Przanski and McPherson, Senator Byer, basically this reflects the probability of something occurring, and so to the extent that it is occurring, it probably does accurately reflect the change in how density occurs. But actually, as you look at fertilization and other activities, the pattern is the same. So, again, it's very clear nationally and in Oregon that as conflicts go up with dwelling density, people choose to manage differently.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Okay. One of the goals, or was it goal or objective, I can't remember which it was, that you listed for the Department of Forestry, and I think there was four or five of them, but one of them was, I'll find it in just a second. It's toward the back. Actually, I thought it was toward the front.
Is that the four broad strategies to promote private forests?
No,
it's the land use program.
Anyway, one of the, and I can't remember how you worded it, if it was goals or objectives of forests in Oregon. Here it is. Major objectives of the department's involvement in state and local planning The one in the list, second list, is to maintain the productivity of the forest land base with continuous, you know, and goes on from there. And I just wonder if you're willing to comment on how productivity, how the productivity of government may run forests compared to private forests.
I'll answer that, cause if that's okay with you.
Sure, I don't care.
Because Ted doesn't do the state lands, and that's part of the department. But it's not the same as industrial. But I think there's some interesting, you know, some interesting comparisons to make. The state owns 3% of the forest land in Oregon, which is not a lot. That last year we harvested 8% of the volume that was harvested in Oregon. So I'd say proportionately we're trying to do, you know, a reasonable share there. We manage about 800,000 acres compared to the federal government's 16 million acres. And if, I don't know if you recall one chart there that Ted showed, we harvest about the same amount of land as they do, of timber as they do. So, it's not the same as an industrial piece of property, but it's reasonable, I think, for a public land model.
If I may, certainly the federal lands are planned to harvest 1 billion board feet, and there is no doubt that if they don't increase their contribution, at least at the plan level, if not something beyond that, there's going to be several consequences on the private lands. One, their risk of wildfire goes up and their willingness to invest goes down. And equally, in some parts of eastern Oregon, if you don't sustain a timber shed that has a good mix of production from all the lands, you're going to lose your infrastructure. We're seeing that already. I guess from my perspective, is the Board of Forestry has very clearly articulated the need for the federal lands to contribute to the Oregon's vitality in ways similar to what's appropriate for that land base and their plans, and that's something substantively more than they're doing now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The other questions I would have don't relate to land use, so I'll hold those for another topic.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Beyer. Representative Clem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've calmed down slightly. I'll try and ask a legitimate question here. You talked about, in number three of the four different strategies, conservation, easements, development rights. We had some testimony from a gentleman here who's got a claim, and he said, you know, if you're not going to let me do my claim, at least use buy the development rights then, something. So my question is, you know, can using some of the federal programs that tap into, you know, conservation resource, and some of this might be farming, I'm not sure, but are there federal programs that we might be able to buy some development rights so the person doesn't have to bear the cost on their own? And if the state wants to have it, farms and forests, can we leverage some federal monies? If, you know, if that's the way the feds want it, let's use some of their money.
Chair Sansky and McPherson, Representative Clem. Indeed, we're trying to pursue the Forest Legacy Program to do that, and I guess it would be our vision that the most efficient way of using those kind of programs is to buy easements rather than title, because the money goes a lot further. So that's what we're intending to do. We also look at the Community Forestry Authority and our notion in Senate Bill 98 of using existing state funds and bonding authority to buy interest in forest land, whether it's whole or partial, again, to extend dollars that will also allow other objectives to be met. In a somewhat sad irony, the Forest Legacy Program is seeing major reductions in this proposed president's budget, about 50% reduction over what it's been. So just now that we're looking at these tools, we're seeing some real challenges in implementing. But again, to the extent we can use easements as opposed to other means, that extends those dollars and allows us to be more successful.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Me?
On those easements, and this probably doesn't apply to forest land so much, but in agriculture, I think the gentleman made the point, could they still live there then, enjoy the use of their land, but they're going to get some money for essentially bearing the cost of the environmental program?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sounds good to me.
Senator George.
Thank you. On the fire interface issues, you caught an issue that I was very interested in, because I was involved in a study in the mid-1990s on the issue of wildfires. And we had some legislation here in the 1990s in the building where we were making sure that that rural residences were paying their fair share of fire suppression costs. And as I understand, as we went through there, there was a careful weighing of the cost added for rural residences to make sure in fire districts and those kind of things that they were paying their fair share. In fact, we had legislation in this building that took people who weren't in fire districts and made sure they were paying their fair share also. And so I guess I was a little caught off guard by your testimony as far as those folks not paying their fair share or the cost of it without them paying it, since we spent so much time here making sure they did.
Senator Przanski and Chair McPherson, Senator George, again, the point was not fair share. It was that basically the risk goes up, the number of dwelling goes up, and the costs go up. Again, it's a policy choice what's fair or not, but there are very significant consequences of people living out in the woods with regard to the fire issue.
If I could on that. That's what I thought you'd say. So here's my follow-up question. I actually was involved in that study, and what we did is we took all of the Department of Forestry reports on where the fires initiated, and we specifically chased down the fires as they on their point of initiation. And we found out two really interesting things from studying that group of data that you folks provided to us, which is I think it was 0.8% between 1993 and 1995. It was less than 1% of the fires actually came from residences in forested areas. What they were is as densities go up, you have human activity go up, and it was actually people from outside of the local area coming in and starting those fires. And actually, when you look at your own data, there's no connection between residences and the fires. They're not the ones starting the fires. It's recreationalists that come into some of those areas and start those fires that are of the human-caused fires. And I was wondering if maybe in the future, when you folks are going through this, if you could start to break out when you start talking about, because that I think it gives a very false impression of who's starting the fires, I guess.
Wasn't any information there about who started the fires.
Folks, this is an informational meeting, and we're trying to get information from the panel here, so I think demonstrations are contrary to our purpose here this evening. Thank you.
I think the important part of that discussion, too, is the cost of fighting fire, not necessarily the incidence that goes up, which it does, and I don't dispute your conclusions there at all, that it's about additional human activity from wherever, but the cost of fighting fire does go up substantially because residents are there. That's just it's a change in tactics and a change in our ability to do specific things that adds cost to the fire suppression.
One last question, though. That's kind of what I thought you'd say. So, what the other part of the study we found is that the Department of Forestry over a number of years, as certain areas got more rural residences, they actually started removing the necessity to have fire lookout stations, because what we found is in areas in the study we were doing in the 1990s, when this whole issue was a big issue, we found is that where you have people who are residents out there, they're the first ones to call the fire. In fact, they found them faster than many of your lookout towers. And so what we got is because there was people in some of those interface areas, you had another part of it, which is not only did they pay a huge cost part of the suppression, but they actually reported the fires earlier, which means we got to them faster and there was less damage. And I guess this particular chart right here sort of disturbed me because it was so contrary to what we saw in the 1990s when we were studying this issue. And if you could comment about the reduction in the number of fire towers, lookout stations necessary because private citizens who live there are reporting those fires earlier, I'd really appreciate it.
Sure. Chairs and Senator George, I don't dispute that at all either. I mean, that's fairly common across the country, again, that as population goes up, the detection methods change rapidly to the point where I used to work in Missouri. We frequently got a telephone call before we heard anything from a lookout tower. That's pretty common. And maybe you're anticipating I'm going to say this too. I'm not sure, but another thing that affects costs positively is access. When access goes up, then we can get to a fire quicker and it stays smaller. So there is those offsetting pieces of it. But in the fuel conditions that you deal with in the West, they're extremely volatile at certain times of the year, and fires can run huge distances in very short periods of time. And in order to stop that, you've got to deploy some very expensive suppression tactics, or they will run over residences, period. And we've got some really good examples of, you know, our deployment of air resources having saved towns, you know, just in the last several years. And but that's an extremely expensive way to fight a fire, but that's the only way to stop them quickly when they're running at a residence.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Garrard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Marvin, we've had several 37 claims on forest land, some of them big. State of Oregon, since part of Measure 37 is compensation, State of Oregon have enough money to compensate those timber companies and buy that land?
Chair, it's Pozanski and McPherson and Representative Garrard, no. We don't. And I don't know that that would be the best policy choice to buy the land. It would be nice, I think, to be able to, how I would describe it is to be able to buy down the real estate value in a lot of cases, and we don't have the money to do that. But as Ted's chart showed, and you know, one of the examples I talked about, and that particular example was in Tennessee, and you know, if you wanted to manage land for timber, it's worth about $75 an acre, and we knew we could put all 175,000 acres out on the market and get $350 an acre for it the next day. And if there were a way to buy down the real estate value from those private landowners and encourage them to keep them in working for us, I think that would be a one reasonable public policy approach. But it's still very expensive.
Follow,
if you may.
Are we acquiring any new forest lands in Oregon? You mentioned 3%.
Right now, no, we're not. We are seeking some additional authority. Go ahead, Ted. I'm sorry.
If I may, the Department of Forestry is not. Certainly other agencies have looked at and have acquired forest land generally in the notion of the conservation or reserve-type forest approach. And, again, that's what concerned us. I mean, we believe that maintaining working forests is important. And so when they get bifurcated into either residential use or reserve forest, it's having a similar impact for different reasons. Now, there are forests that need to be older structure, that kind of stuff. But tendency is for agencies to want to buy conservation purpose forests, and we've seen some industrial lands go that route through other purchases by other state agencies.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Clem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions. One actually got triggered on the compensation thing. Do you think that we actually have been using a fair valuation process like might be used in a real taking thus far, where a third neutral party sets what the value is and it's challengeable in court? Or are we just essentially saying, what do you think you lost? And, you know, we don't factor in property tax deferrals. We don't factor in anything. It's what do you think you lost? And then we say, well, we can't pay even a buck, so you might as well just let it go.
Pozanski and McPherson and Representative Clement, that's a really good question. And it actually, I had a conversation with some colleagues in another part of the country not too long ago where there's been a lot of conservation easement purchase, and was asking, you know, have we got the market valuation of that right at this point? And the answer is nobody really knows for sure. Not many of those conservation easement properties have gone back on the market to kind of know how the total value of the property is impacted, and there really just isn't a mature buyer-seller, you know, condition out there right now to know exactly.
One more question.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is on the landslide deal. You know, I remember hearing in the news about the people had their houses out on the ocean cliff and was going to slide in because of nature. That particular one, that's a right down the road from my dad's house across the river. I guess what I'm wondering about is are those slides man-made slides, or is it that man locates right near where slides naturally occur?
Chair Pozanski and McPherson, Representative Clem, basically what we're talking about is shallow, rapid landslides. They're a natural phenomenon. Clearly, management activities can influence them in several ways, both in terms of timing and their downstream effects. But generally, they're natural, and they are going to occur. And it is disingenuous for us to tell anybody that by not doing any forest management, you're safe locating a house there, because you are at risk. And just to kind of give you another example, which big concern, the Scottsburg area, which is a huge area of risk. And again, we've got a number of ballot measure 37 claims in that area that would result in home sites being placed in areas that are at very high risk. One of them would result in a multiple pie things coming right down the steep slope to the bottom with a home on each site. Again, those things are a pretty big concern to us.
Follow up to that one. That's a very good point. The question is, do you know whether or not the safety exemptions would allow a denial because there might be a slide at some point, or is that safety? I mean, I'm trying to figure some of this stuff out.
We have had one ballot measure 37 claim on that. It's not gone very far. Actually, it's the only one directly related to forest practice at this point in time. We would deny it on the safety exemption. The dilemma really comes, this isn't a ballot measure 37 issue, really. That there are people that have home sites out there for a number of reasons, or properties. In many cases, they are in areas that will allow a home. There isn't the process to provide the oversight to say you shouldn't build or you're planning on building. And there is a process in place to get mapping and to direct the counties to provide that oversight, but that's not been completed for a number of reasons.
Co-Chair Brzozinski had his hand up a moment ago.
Thank you. I guess, Ted, one of the things I didn't see in the presentation, which I thought you may be covering, is just the number of claims that are in the private forest areas that are either adjacent to state forest or ones that you're managing, overseeing. And I'm wondering if y'all have done any type of tracking and documenting as to the impact. You alluded to it as to down the Scottsburg area, which is part of my area. And I know that there's a lot of concern for what, say, is maybe natural in the way of slides, but at the same time has been enhanced because of how some of the management practices have been and actually resulted in a loss of life. So I'm wondering if you have any data that you could bring back to us that would, in fact, give the impression from the department as to the claims that are currently on private forest lands and how that might impact the availability of those lands to stay in forestry, and also what other risks, such as health or safety, that we may have.
Chair Brzozinski, we do our best on that. We only are aware of two county maps, one from Washington County, one from Lane, that shows a map of the claims. And for Lane County, several are in the Siusla and McKenzie drainages in those kind of areas where landslides are a possibility. Little bit of caution, it is somewhat would be somewhat disingenuous for us to assume that people are actually going to go forward with any set of developments based upon their claim or not. Again, using one example in Washington County where timber companies got a fairly broad area of claims, I would suspect they're trying to protect their rights and not necessarily really wanting to develop things. So we don't want to be disingenuous about the impact either, but there is some probably legitimate ways for us to get good information to you on that.
If I can follow up, on the two counties that you mentioned, knowing of some of the large claims that have been filed, is there not maps for Lincoln County or Coos County?
Chair Brzozinski, I don't know. We've looked for maps. There may well be ones that we've not yet found, but we will continue to do that. If you're aware of them, we'd be happy to round them up. But we've looked at Benton, Lincoln, Lane, which we got, Washington County, Jackson, and Josephine. We didn't find maps immediately available, but they could be available now. Thank you.
Senator George?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking at this particular chart right here, which is the number of acres in private land in Western Oregon, and some of the questions sort of keyed in something we had the other night. I just want to do my math correctly here. The other night when we had the Department of Ag in here, they showed us the information from 1950 through 1973 where we saw a significant reduction in agricultural land from the 50s to the 70s. And they drew that from the Census of Agriculture. And I guess the conclusion we were supposed to decide from that those conversions were to non-farm uses, specifically urbanized uses. So I went to the Census of Agriculture since that night, and what I found was it was a big conversion of land, of farmland to forest land. And then they showed a flattening out of that curve after 1973, and actually slightly more land was brought into agricultural use. And so based on my kind of what we heard the other night, where we were supposed to be given the impression that this was converted to something other than agricultural land, it went to forest land. And then looking at this chart, if we went back to what, if we did the same thing the Department of Ag did to us the other day, would we see a huge increase in forest land up to 73 and then a stabilization and a shift back to farmland? Because I guess there really hasn't been any real zoning changes, and there hasn't been any major things that were included in the urban growth boundary weren't included in that. And so are these numbers handy to us at all? Because it seems like to me what we're talking about here, the difference between your testimony and Department of Ag testimony, is a conversion of ag land to forest land and then back from forest land to ag land.
Chair McPherson, Senator George, what we do have in terms of the perspective look on the last 20, 30 years is a fairly good data set, and we will look and try and get stuff prior to that. I think it's fair to say, and this is anecdotally, that at least for the Willamette Valley, there has been a historic loss of forest land, but certainly on like the Coast Range, a lot of that was converted to agriculture and then grew back to forestry as time went on. So there's probably a number of effects that may have occurred there, but it would probably be regional in outcome, I guess.
Mr. Chairman, just a follow-up comment. I guess the point for me is it would be easier for the committee, I think, to process this information. When the Department of Ag was here, they gave us the impression that this land was being converted to a use that was non-agriculture and therefore urban. And when I went to the Census of Agriculture and looked, that wasn't exactly the correct impression. And this chart here gives us an impression that somehow land is being converted into an urban use. And based on the Census of Agriculture, I would say it probably got converted back to agriculture use. And if we could just have a better picture of those two things between the Department of Ag and Department of Forestry, that way we're not left with any false impression up here, if I could. That'd be really appreciated.
Mr. Chair, just one last sentiment before you nice gentlemen leave. In your PowerPoint, you talked about we haven't been doing much in the increasing traditional forestry profitability area. Also, you talked about apparently Canada, you know, did some things to really help their industry. And I heard the sentiment, which I have heard a lot, and I don't disagree that global conditions and global factors are making this hard. I mean, you know, my family's involved in pear growing, and it's brutally difficult. But I guess I would want, you got the chair of the Agriculture Committee sitting right there, the vice chair here and another vice chair here, so if you can work with us in that committee to get us information on how to make forestry and agriculture more profitable, because I'm just not ready to give up yet. I don't care what the global world says. But I know it means we have to make real reforms in Oregon. And it doesn't mean we don't get these people paid something, too. But please get us whatever ideas you can.
Chairs Brzezinski and McPherson, Representative Clem, a couple of the most important things that you can do to increase profitability. One is in new technology and product innovation on the production side, increasing productivity. And on the cost-cutting side is making sure you have a solid science foundation for whatever you're going to impose as regulatory costs.
Mm-hmm.
We're engaged in both of those at Oregon State University in improving the productivity of planted forests and getting the science done so that our streamside management rules are, mm-hmm. are adequate but not excessive. Mm-hmm. In the Oregon Wood Innovation Center, in helping businesses develop better business practices, new wood products, new markets. So, and at least part of the answer to your question is investments in your land-grant university's R&D capacity. Thanks for the opportunity.
Nice softball.
And he makes the pitch to a former OSU student body president, so
I'm not going
to
say nice
we
softball.
We didn't team up on that, I swear.
I guess if I may, Chair Brzezinski and McPherson, Representative Clement, and certainly one of the things we hear from the family forest landowner is that they benefit very greatly from assistance. And again, part of the point of this is you look at the residential forest sector, we've done very little to help them, you know, whether that's direct assistance or cost share programs or whatever, and that's where I think there's a real opportunity to give them opportunity to get a better value for their product. And many of them don't know how to market their timber, and again, the classic, I started my career in Washington County, and the classic at that time was the logger said, look, I'll cut down your trees and market them for half their value. And, you know, which maybe when it's $100 a thousand, that was a good deal. When it was $500 a thousand, they were not getting a good deal. And they don't have the expertise. And helping these people capture that value is really important. There's been, bluntly, a disinvestment in those kind of assistance programs across the nation and certainly in Oregon.
Gentlemen, I have one question, which is I've heard the argument that if we take timberlands that are owned in very large parcels now and we introduce new residences into forest lands on smaller forest land tracts, that those forest land tracts will be managed more intensively and effectively than they will as large tracts in their current ownership. Could you comment on whether that's a good argument or not?
Well, Chair McPherson, Chair Gansky, members of the committee, they'll be managed probably differently, and you know, it's a value judgment whether it's good or bad. But let me give you a hypothetical example. There is a piece of land that's likely to go up for sale near LeGrand around Mount Emily, and under the current zoning laws, a dwelling could be allowed on every 240 acres as forest zone, 3,500 acres. They could put 15 dwellings on that property. Again, based upon the kind of person that can afford those acreage sizes, they're going to have a different set of objectives around how they're going to manage that. They also often have a real different perspective over what's natural, and they oftentimes bring in other uses. Again, not as good or bad, but grazing may be changed from the traditional grazing to something might be more of a hobby type event. Timber management would probably be de-emphasized. Certainly they would want to be protective of their residential values. They might object to federal harvest on adjacent federal lands. And so it's a different mix, and it has a set of consequences that have been repeated over and over again nationally, and they're pretty well known and established, and generally it results in less timber production and usually some other unintended consequences that really are not necessarily in the working forest arena necessarily a positive thing, but it's certainly going to be different.
Chairman, can I add something?
Please, Dean.
In the case that Ted Lorenzen just mentioned, in all likelihood, the 3,500 acres is open to public access right now, but when it gets chunked out into 250-acre private home sites, the public access might be drastically different.
If there are no further questions for the panel, gentlemen, thank you very much. That's very informative and is useful to the committee. That concludes our informational meeting. Thank you, committee, for your attendance. We're adjourned.